What's the overall theme, David, of singularity, if you would?
Well, singularity for me started actually, after 20 some odd years of practicing meditation daily. During the worst year of my life in 1994, I got visited by the most unbelievably, supremely beautiful, shining being of light that I'm not going to say whose name this being is, on the air, but, if people will find out in the end of my book if they read it. But this being was so powerful and so bright when this being appeared to me, I fell upon my face. I could barely look upon his most supremely beautiful face. And the whole universe was manifesting out of this, who I call the supreme being. And this is where, with this being, I was taught singularity. And it took me years. In fact, Singularity as a book is really my greatest, I will call it my greatest work and my greatest achievement in my life, which I hope to be, evolving more and more as I get older.
That is huge, David, for an individual to say that about oneself, and so it really must be very important to you.
It's so important to me because what I was being taught in the presence of the Supreme Being fallen on my face, barely able to look, thousands of times brighter than our sun, and the levels of love and ecstasy and peace and power and beauty and wisdom and graces is even brighter than the light. In fact, it's not even the light that made it so difficult to look, but actually the power and the magnitude of this being. But what started to happen was that the teachings I received in that presence, I was able to verify in, ancient spiritual manuscripts from different religions. I could see cross-sectioning different religions that the same information was there. In fact, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, and also in mystic Christianity, in the Nag Hammadi Library, I found a wealth of information in the Gospel of Thomas. And then I started applying that to the highest ideals in quantum physics to solve the three great, what I call the three great inertias. And those three great inertias are, the first is the psychological inertia over the knowledge of good and evil, which is the root cause of inner conflict, depression, separating us from the whole, the one, the unenlightened state of mind that leads to war, genocide, and other terrifying corruptions, which we're all facing on this planet right now, and you were talking about that earlier. The second inertia is the inertia of movement, and this one's really interesting because in the Nag Hammadi Library, which is, of course, where Dan Brown's, many of his source material comes from, in what's called the trimorphic protonoia, there's the most profound, simple sentence that I just meditate on. I mean, it's like a Zen koan to me. It says that humanity, after the fall, being cast out of the Garden of Eden, we were cast down to the lowest region of all matter in the universe. And it doesn't say geographically the lowest region of the universe. It says the lowest region of all matter. So I often wonder if that code, that actual code that is on matter, which I will demonstrate, prevents us from even seeing other intelligent and even biological beings that may be living on our other nine planets and other planets in our own galaxy. The very fact that NASA can't find other intelligent life in the universe may be because of this code that our matter is actually coded with, which I'll demonstrate. The third inertia is the inertia of disease, death, and the actual physical,
like the aging process,
disease, death, and how we actually die. I mean, we only live for 100 years. A good man will live 100 years if he's lucky, and it's kind of like that same time clock. You have 100 years to make your mark, to do something with your life, to experience this thing before the great mystery reveals itself to you again. So for me, those three problems are the greatest problems that human beings face: the fact that we die, the fact that we can't move anywhere, that matter as it is, according to Einstein's law, matter in its current state, I rephrase, cannot move faster than the speed of light. And the speed of light is not fast enough to get anywhere in this universe. I mean, God gave us a really tough problem here. And then, of course, the first one and the great one is war. Why do all the religions fight? And I was actually in the presence of this being receiving the teachings that could answer all of these, but it's taken me years. That was in 1994, to actually, like in a game of chess, prove it to people. And the only way I could prove it is compare the spiritual models with models in quantum physics. So I started with, and we've, just as a brief overview, we've done the three great inertias in the shows before, and this is very detailed in my book, which is now available. The first inertia I call the psychological inertia, which is over the knowledge of good and evil. When Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, they were in paradise. They originally lived in singularity or oneness. And God warned them, never partake of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day you do, you will surely die. It doesn't say God will kill them, that God will do anything horrible to them. It says you will die. And that death is actually what I can actually demonstrate. I can actually demonstrate how that happens after we partake of this knowledge of good and evil. In fact, in the Nag Hammadi Library, Trimorphic Protonoia, there are clear statements contradictory to most theological views that the knowledge of good and evil represents chaos. It represents conflict. If you see in your mind right now, if we ingest the knowledge of good and evil, what we're ingesting is a conflict. So going from a state of innocence or enlightenment or oneness, once you ingest conflict is, it cannot survive in a state of love. A state of love is peaceful. It's a state of union where there's no conflict. That is what love is. That is what peace is. So conflict can't exist in peace, so it falls into a lower dimension where it works itself out. Now, when 8 billion people take in the knowledge of good and evil, they identify good and evil egotistically for themselves alone, and when they compare it with their neighbor, of course, they find out we disagree. In fact, rarely do we ever agree 100% on anything. In fact, everybody has a different viewpoint about everything. But some of us generally agree, so we agree to form, corporations, businesses, relationships, and then religions. And even a single religion becomes divided hundreds and hundreds of times. And actually documented, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, all of the great religions are divided in more than 100 times. And in fact, Jesus says in the Gospels that how can Satan's kingdom stand and survive if it is divided? So what this does is, because we absolutely believe that our interpretation of our own religion is correct and the other wrong, we actually get into this trap, this game. We believe it so strongly, we hold it against the other. We even tell our son and our daughter that you can't marry a person who disagrees with our family religion. Mm-hmm. And, meanwhile, the son or the daughter is in love and they want to fall in love with this person and marry them, and the parents, protest. And this is the beginning of the starvation of love in the soul. Because we're not experiencing union, love, we're in this state of conflict. We starve. I actually saw this in the presence of this Supreme Being, that the duality of good and evil produces a oval or egg-shaped force field around the human soul, and it shields out the omnipresent singularity of the oneness of God. And so we don't experience that connectedness anymore.